The psalmist said it well. In the 133rd Psalm, "Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. It is a wonderful thing when brethren can work and they can worship together in harmony." Division, on the other hand, causes unpleasantness in contrast to what the psalmist says here, and confusion, and is the result of sin. On the same street where this building is located, on Hughes Road, there is another and a different Church of Christ, the Madison Church of Christ. We get some of their mail at the post office, and I suspect they get some of ours. We both have boxes at the same Madison post office. But the confusion that exists between us is much greater than whether or not mail comes to the right box. We get phone calls all the time from people who want to know about our Mother's Day Out program. We don't have such a program, but apparently Madison does. And I steer them to the proper number, inform them they apparently have the wrong number. But it's confusing to people. I can hear it in their voices. Our relationship as two churches of Christ in the same town, and yet apparently somewhat different. Whatever differences exist between us now, things that might be of fundamental difference between us and the Madison Church of Christ, those differences began with an issue that is known as institutionalism. And it is institutionalism that I want to spend a few moments talking about this morning. It is my intention to review just very briefly, emphasis on briefly, the history of this issue of institutionalism. But I really want to note some of the errors that are involved in institutionalism. And I suppose if there was a third purpose that we could assign to our study this morning, it would be to emphasize to each of us both the importance and the completeness of the church that Jesus established. Jesus said, "On this rock I will build my church. Gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." And the fact of the matter is, you and I, as members of the Lord's body, enjoy a very special relationship that ought not to be denigrated or minimized in any way by any institution or human arrangement. And yet that's my fear, as we talk about institutionalism, that that very thing is being done. What exactly is institutionalism? Institutionalism refers to the committing of the work of a local congregation to some other organization that is human either in its origin and or design. It may be that a local congregation doesn't turn over all of its work, but maybe just some portion of its work. Let me give you an illustration. It is not uncommon for us to receive from time to time letters that ask for our support in either building or maintaining homes for unwed mothers or others who have benevolent needs. And of course, the object of the letter is to solicit our monetary support for this particular home. This home is an institution, it is an organization in and of itself. Typically, these homes have some sort of board of director or a manager or something of that nature. They're not churches. They're organizations within their own right. And of course, the idea is that we would send money to this organization and this home would be maintained, built and maintained. And then if there should arise the need for an unwed mother to be supported, we would simply send the unwed mother to that home, and the home would take care of her or assist her in her needs, as opposed to, say, for instance, Christians helping Christians within the context of a local congregation. That's institutionalism. It's where we take our responsibility toward the work of the local church in some aspect, and we shunt it on to some other organization, some institution. Now, it is commonly thought that institutionalism began or occurred about 40 years ago. And it is certainly true that back in the 1950s and in the early 60s, there was a division among churches of Christ in this country. And that division took place as a result of institutions. But the fact of the matter is, institutionalism really began over a century earlier. Because you see, back in the mid-1900s, as certain individuals, Alexander Campbell included, began to feel the need to do more evangelism, they reasoned that the only way that would be possible would be to pool the efforts of local congregations. And so Campbell and others, incidentally, encouraged what were known as cooperation meetings. Churches in an area would get together, and they would coordinate their efforts in trying to evangelize that particular area. And area coordination meetings gave rise to state coordination meetings with some form of organization even. But that wasn't good enough, not active enough, effective enough. And so Campbell suggested in his periodical that there really needed to be some sort of a missionary society in which the efforts of lots of congregations could be put together, joined together, and evangelism could be done in a more efficient and expeditious manner. And so there were a number of missionary societies that were formulated. And you can see on the screen some, I hope you can see on the screen, some dates and names of those missionary societies, even after the Civil War, although brethren tended to be divided during the Civil War on some of these very missionary societies. Those societies were essentially, at least in this country, the beginning of institutionalism, because they were separate entities from local churches. And in many cases had their own organization, their own officers. Alexander Campbell, while he opposed the American Christian Bible Society, was quite happy to be president of the American Christian Missionary Society, formed only 4 years later. I guess you just have to ask. But these were organizations that had their own, or institutions, I should say, that had their own organizations. And so they, in a sense, heralded the beginning of institutionalism even prior to the last century. In the 1930s, brethren began to advocate church support of Bible colleges. Congregations were encouraged and solicited to send funds from their treasuries to various Bible colleges, and even orphans' homes, which began to appear around the turn of the 20th century. I think the earliest one is dated about 1909 in this country. And churches were encouraged to send to the orphans' home. Church support of colleges didn't receive as much encouragement or support, if you'll pardon the pun, but orphans' homes had the emotional appeal. What are we going to do with these little children? You can't just leave them without a home. And so churches began to send their money to orphans' homes. Now, mind you, this is an institution separate and apart from a local congregation, just like a Bible college is. And then brethren woke up and said, wait a second, it's really parallel if you can send money to an orphan's home for the purpose of benevolence. Why can't you send money to a Bible college for the purpose of edification? You're teaching the Bible. And they were right. They are parallel. If you can support one institution, there really isn't any reason why you can't support the other institution. In 1954, as I recall, that's not the correct date. It was in the 50s. The Herald of Truth was established in Abilene, Texas. It was financed by a sponsoring church arrangement. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that, but basically that's the situation where one church decides they're going to embark upon some program of work that they're really not financially capable of sustaining. And so they solicit funds from other churches who become the contributing churches as opposed to the sponsoring church, and the sponsoring church runs the show. And the other churches send their money to the sponsoring church, and they all are cooperating in whatever work the sponsoring church is doing. And that's how the Herald of Truth began. At least that's how it was done originally. Now, some of these institutions, when people began to question about sending money to an institution, they baptized them. How do you baptize an institution? Well, you find some eldership of a local congregation who's willing to take oversight of the institution. And that makes it legal. That makes it scriptural now because it's under the oversight of elders. That's called baptizing it, making it look good. And the fact of the matter is that's been done with a number of institutions, but questions arose and the division occurred. Now, widespread division usually takes place over a period of time, but often there are some catalysts, some events that tend to set things in motion. The Herald of Truth was one of those catalysts. The Herald of Truth caused some brethren to begin questioning things that were already being done. Incidentally, up until that time, sponsoring church arrangement was already being used by a number of congregations. There were a number of orphans' homes already being supported by Churches of Christ. There was already institutionalism being practiced, but when the Herald of Truth came, people began to look at that and say, is this right? Is this what we should be doing? And that opened the floodgates. There was a lot of controversy and some rather significant debates that took place, questioning about whether the church had the right to send money to an institution to do some sort of, some portion of the church's work. Another catalyst to the division occurred in 1954 in the December issue of the Gospel Advocate. On the editorial page of that magazine, an individual wrote in and suggested that all those preachers who opposed church support of colleges, orphans' homes, the Herald of Truth, and other human innovations or institutions needed to be quarantined. Cut them off. And across the country, that advice was followed. And preachers did lose their jobs. They were just simply removed from the pulpit because they opposed institutionalism. They opposed giving the work of a local church to some other organization that was human in its origin. And the division over a period of years just kind of spread across the country. The church in which I grew up or that my family attended while I grew up, that church split. I was too young to remember what really was going on. I just knew there was one outside of town and then there was us. And we didn't agree on things. That split was a part of this institutionalism split. But brethren, understand institutionalism had been around for a long time. Now, it's sad when a single congregation divides over any particular issue. Institutionalism divided a brotherhood. It divided church after church after church, not all in the same week or the same time, but over the course of a few years, it divided an entire brotherhood, that is, at least in this country. And the situation now is that there's your brotherhood and our brotherhood. Churches that are non-institutional and churches that are in favor of supporting institutions. Now, many brethren at the time and even since then have argued that the issue was just simply methods, that it was a lot of to-do about nothing. It was a question of what was expeditious. And in fact, the argument of expediency was often used to justify these new institutions, even as it had been used to justify the missionary societies. It's just an effective way of doing it. It's just a method. I've even heard the expression, and I've read it certainly, that was spoken by some who supported institutions in response to the objection of others. Their argument was, we prefer our way of doing it to your way of not doing it, which is kind of a thumb in your eye type of way of saying, you're just not doing very much and we're busy. I want you to listen closely to what I'm going to say. Activity never is a substitute for authority. Something isn't good simply because it's going on. if brethren weren't doing evangelism, then they needed to get busy and do it. But you don't invent a new plan. You don't go outside of the divine plan and pattern and find your own way of doing it and then say, well, it's better to do it this way than not to do it at all. You're really still in the same boat, aren't you? Because if you're not doing it, then you're not acceptable to God, and those who go outside of God's plan are unacceptable to Him also. You haven't really improved your situation when you improve upon God's plan, have you? There are two fundamental questions behind the institutional issue, at least as I understand the issue as it was debated. The first one was, what was the work of the local church as a collective group? There were some who were arguing that churches ought not to be sending to orphans' homes because the orphans' home is a separate institution from the local church. There were others who were asking the question of whether the local church is really responsible for the support of orphans at all. Those are two different questions. One is, what is the work of the local church? And the second question is, who's supposed to do that work? And both of those questions were fundamental to this issue and its discussion in the early 50s and even into the early 60s of the last decade, the last century rather. Well, that gives you an idea of the history of the issue of institutionalism. Obviously, that's just a very quick survey. But let me tell you what I believe is the trouble with institutions or institutionalism. And I think the first and foremost point to be made is that basically there is disrespect shown for God's plan and by implication for God Himself. God's plan gets set aside. God's plan is that the local church, either as a collective body or as individual Christians in a distributive sense, that we do certain work. In fact, not all that long ago, I preached a sermon on the mission of the local church. We talked about the fact that the local church has as its mission evangelism, and edification, and discipline, and limited benevolence. And God has set out a plan, a means for that work to get done. And His plan is that every member contributes according to the ability that we have, and as a whole, we accomplish this work. Turn, if you will, to the book of Ephesians, to chapter 4. Let's begin reading in verse 11. Ephesians 4 and verse 11. God made provisions for local churches to be able to do their work. And He Himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. We should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men, in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. The body grows and is strengthened by that which every part supplies. God has made provision for the local congregation to do its work by providing apostles, prophets. Someone says, we don't have any apostles. Sure we do. Can you not read the writing of the Apostle Paul even today? Is that not his teaching yet with us? And Peter said, I write these things that so that when I put off this tabernacle, you may have a reminder of those things, he says in 2 Peter. We still have the writing of 2 Peter and 1 Peter, one of the apostles, and of course other inspired individuals likewise. And we have pastors and teachers and evangelists. Those are gifts from God for the church to do its work. And God set out His plan. You see it in action in Acts chapter 4. There were needy saints. So what did they do? Did they send money, the local church, to some organization that then turned around and took care of the needy saints? No. Brethren sold possessions, gave of their own possessions, and everybody was provided for in Acts chapter 4. Later on, when the need was even greater than what the Jerusalem congregation could sustain, could meet, then other congregations likewise sent from their own means to help needy saints. That's God's plan, and it got the job done. Talked last week about evangelism, and one of the points we made from Colossians 1 and verse 23 is that in the first century, a mere 30 years after the church was established, Paul could write that the gospel had been preached to every creature in the earth. And so the church was adequate to do the job according to God's plan. There's a conspicuous absence of any human institution in the New Testament assuming the work of local churches. Is that accidental? Were people in the first century just not smart enough to figure out how efficient that is? Or were they just simply following the plan that God laid out? These human institutions, regardless of what kind of work they have been designed to accomplish, that work that belongs to the local church, they are plants which God has not planted. And Jesus' comment about those kinds of plants in Matthew chapter 15, verse 13, is that they're going to be rooted up. And so will these institutions. They are unauthorized by Scripture. May I make an observation to you, lest anybody try to make the dodge to you in a discussion of this particular topic? If I say to you that there is no mention of any human institution in the New Testament, you know how people sometimes respond to that? Well, you can't find any mention of a PA system in the New Testament, but you use it, don't you? And what they're doing is they're suggesting that the absence of something in the New Testament means that it is unauthorized. The fact of the matter is, a PA system is just a means of teaching, and teaching and preaching are authorized. My comment is, you don't find any human institutions in the New Testament because they are unauthorized, not because they're generically unauthorized under some other command. But they are fundamentally flawed. And that's why you don't find any authority for them, nor mention of them, obviously. I mentioned that one of the common arguments that is used to justify institutions is that they're just methods. And they're expedient methods. And I'm all for expediency. I think we ought to do things in the most effective, authorized way possible. But you see, expediency, or just an effective way of doing something, doesn't authorize anything. Something must first be authorized, and then you may find an expedient way to do that if the specific method of doing it hasn't been specified. I think we need to be careful about saying, well, this is just an expediency. All expediencies must first be authorized. And so the first problem with institutions is that God's plan gets set aside. And man enters with his own institution, his own organization, to assume what God had given to the church. The second problem is that institutions imply that the local congregation is ineffective, that it is incapable or inadequate of doing its own work. The question needs to be asked, do we need these institutions to do the work of the Gooch Lane congregation, or are we capable of doing the work that God has assigned to us? Now, if those institutions are necessary, I'll tell you a corollary to this particular point, and that is that the Bible you've got is incomplete. Paul could write to Timothy in the first century in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 16 and 17 that the Scriptures were adequate to make the man of God complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work, and yet there's not one jot or tittle of information about human institutions designed to assist the local congregation in doing its work. And if we need those institutions, then tell me why the Scriptures never said anything about them, never authorized them, never gave us any inclination about how they should be organized or set up. I go with Paul. Paul said the Scriptures were complete, thoroughly equipping the man of God, and they don't say anything about the institutions because you don't need them, and neither does this congregation. God's given us everything we do need in order to accomplish the work that He's given this local congregation and us as individuals to do. And I'll tell you another problem with institutions is there's just no stopping place. No stopping place. One of the arguments that was made against the Herald of Truth sponsoring church arrangement, the Herald of Truth had set out as its goal to obtain contributions from 1,000 churches across the nation. I don't know why 1,000, but 1,000 was the original goal. And some bright light in the debate said, why stop at 1,000? Why not have 5,000 or 10,000? Why not have every church in the world send funds to the church there, I think it was the Broad Street Church in Abilene, Texas, or Highland Avenue, excuse me, and have them operate, you know, take care of the money of all these churches, and what we'll have is something comparable to the Roman Catholic Church. Oh, no, no, we can't do that. But if you can send money for one thing, and one church can do it, why can't a second one? Why couldn't a third? Why can't they all do it? Where does it stop? And that's my point about institutions. If you and I can send money to an orphan's home so that when we have a problem with benevolence, we just let the orphan's home take care of it, so we delegate our benevolence, if that is indeed our benevolent work, and I said limited benevolence, I don't believe it is, but we can just delegate a benevolent work to that particular institution. Why can't we do that with our evangelism? Let's send money to a missionary society. Why can't we do that with our edification? Why are we fooling around with this business of preaching and teaching and all that? We'll send our money to an edification society or some sort of institution which will then take care of our edification for us. We don't have to do anything. In fact, really all you'll do is just show up on Sunday. Would we need a worship society? Could they do that for us too? But we'd show up on Sunday and we'd take the Lord's Supper and put our money in the plate and someone would gather the money and just send it off to all the different institutions and we'll just let them do all of our work. If they can do some of it, why can't they do all of it? Do you see the reasoning that I'm suggesting to you? Because you see, if it's legitimate for us to turn over our benevolent responsibilities to an institution, why not evangelism? Why not edification? Why not discipline? There is no stopping place. We can do all of those things. Now someone says, oh, that's carrying it. You're being ridiculous. No, I'm just carrying that principle to its logical end. And I'll tell you something else about this. And that is that institutionalism introduces additional opportunities for abuse and even immoral behavior and false teaching. You know what happened to the Herald of Truth? It got out of hand. And brethren who once supported the Herald of Truth would not want to be linked with it under any circumstances. They were sending their money, churches were, to the Herald of Truth, but they weren't determining the teaching that was being done. And some fellas got a hold of the program and they started teaching things that a lot of these churches that had been sending their money would not countenance. But their money was going for false teaching. You know what? If there's false teaching comes from this pulpit, it only happens once. Because the elders control that work here. This congregation says, nope, not here. And it gets stopped. Now I'm going to tell you a story about a personal friend of mine. And you'll relate to this story because it has to do with the Child Haven Orphans Home in Cullman, Alabama. This friend of mine grew up in that home. He was a ward of that particular home, supported by all kinds of local congregations. I did not know this until after we had been acquaintances, friends for a long time, that while he was a resident of that particular orphan's home, he was abused, physically abused, to the point that he was beaten with a belt so violently that when he laid in bed at night and get up in the morning, the sheet would stick to his back from the fluids that had dried coming off of his back. Churches were sending money to this home. They had no idea that there was irresponsible people running it, that there was child abuse going on in the home. And I'll tell you, the reason they didn't know is because they didn't control the work that was being done. That was done by the institution, by the board of directors or whoever it was that was handling that particular institution. And that's what happens with institutionalism. You lose control over the work that's being done. And you don't get to determine whether it's being done in the right way and by responsible individuals. And so I think institutions introduce additional opportunities for these kinds of things. Let me just close this morning by suggesting to you that the creating of human organizations to do the work of the church sets aside God's plan, and you and I don't have a right to do that. And secondly, and very importantly, it minimizes the church that the Lord established. And the church slides into the background. That body of people for whom Jesus Christ died, while the institution is glorified and the church just simply becomes a supporter. When I was preaching in Groves, Texas, just right around the corner from us, maybe a half a mile away, there was a large group there, Church of Christ, and they supported institutions and the social gospel for that matter. But they were conservative institutional brethren as opposed to the liberal institutional brethren. You see, among those groups that are willing to support institutions, there's a broad spectrum. There are some that just are willing to do practically anything. They're really not much different from the denominations anymore. And then there are brethren that are fairly close to our practices, except that they would favor institutions and in some cases the social gospel. Well, this group was on the conservative end of that spectrum. And the preacher of that church called me one day, and he wanted to meet with me, and I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. We didn't have much contact normally. So we got together, and he said, listen, I'm just worried about what's happening to my brotherhood. His brotherhood. The group of Christians that agree with him. He said, in my brotherhood, the vast majority of them are going out into left field. He said, the fact of the matter is, we're closer, the congregation that he's working with, we're closer to you than we are to our own brethren. We are brethren. Okay? We were both baptized into Christ by the same plan. Christians. But you understand what he meant, and so did I. And I said to him, I said, he wanted to know if there wasn't some way that we could have a closer relationship, some sort of fellowship, you know, you announce our meetings, we'll announce your meetings, and blah, that sort of thing. And I said, well, you know, I wish we could. The ball's in your court. And then I explained to him what I meant by that. I said to him, you believe that institutions are permitted but not necessary, not demanded. Meaning, of course, that you can use them, but you could also give them up. I, on the other hand, do not believe that they are permitted and cannot use them under any circumstances. It seems to me that of the two parties here, you can move to my side, but I can't move to your side. And all of us maintain our conscience, do what we think is right. So in other words, if you want fellowship, it's simple. Give up the institutions, and then we can work on the same plan, and we can be together on some stuff. Last conversation I had with him. Not going to do it. He didn't want our fellowship that badly. Isn't that a shame? How good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell in unity. Every time man introduces his own think-sos, his own plans, and his own organizations, guess what? Brethren get divided. And if brethren would just put away these institutions and just follow the plan, the divine plan, then we wouldn't have those problems. Or we'd have other problems. We might bicker over which songbook to use, but we'd have minor problems. We could be working together harmoniously. We could have fellowship with one another. And unfortunately, it doesn't appear that's going to happen. Well, I appreciate so very much your attention this morning. I always hesitate to, if you will pardon the expression, to air dirty laundry on a Sunday in a sermon. But there's a principle here. There are several principles here that are significant. And one of the most fundamental is the respect for God's authority. Because I'll tell you what, if you surrender that, whether you're talking about in the matter of institutionalism or anything else, you are lost. You can't walk with God. And in fact, for an individual to become a Christian in the first place, the very first thing they've got to do is submit to God's authority. God said, here's the plan. All those who will come to me will come through my Son. John 14, Jesus said it. And so those who believe in Jesus as the Son of God and are willing to repent of their sins, Acts 2 and verse 38, and be baptized upon their confession of their faith for the remission of their sins, baptized, those are the people who will be saved. That's God's plan. And I tell you what, there is no end run around that. You either follow the plan and you submit to God's authority, or you just don't become part of His people. So everything starts with submission. And then it continues. Even as Christians, we have to live continually submitting to the authority of God in faithful obedience to the things that He's laid out. You don't ever stop doing that. And if you need to start doing that this morning, why not come to the front? We'll assist you in becoming a New Testament Christian. We encourage you even as we stand and sing, Happiness is in the Lord.